Of special programs coming up soon. The first one is next Sunday. We have a mantra workshop. Guruji's been encouraging us for a few years to do more mantra and challenging people to say a million mantras. So if you would like to get inspired and join the club, please join us for that program. It's from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. and I'm told you can also join us online for that. And then on Saturday, November 23rd, Guruji's going to be doing a question and answer satsang. So if there is a question that you've been wanting to ask Guruji, now is your opportunity. You can write your questions down and you can leave them at reception, or you can email them to info@theashram.com.au. And for more information about our courses, or to register for any of the programs, you can visit our website, theashram.com.au. The bookstore is now open, and everyone is invited to come up for darshan. If you'd like to make an offering, you can do so at the basket near Guruji, and please come up now.
Well, welcome everybody to tonight's program, to satsang, the company of the truth. We're in the company of the great teachings of the great beings tonight. And when you have that company, it's always uplifting. So I always begin by quoting my guru, Swami Muktananda, who began every program by saying in Hindi, "Sabko bare sanmane ke saath prem se hridik swagat." With great respect and love, I welcome you all with all my heart. And Baba was the guru of welcoming. He said that to welcome another, he said that to worship another person is to worship God. You didn't need deities and all kinds of things, because a living human being is the embodiment of God. So you should worship the one that's closest to you, that's you. And that's sometimes the hardest thing, is to love yourself instead of hate yourself. And then to welcome other people with love. Now, mind you, it doesn't mean become stupid, but it means to love everyone and pass the ammunition. Be careful. Use your brain. So I also want to welcome everyone who's watching at this camera, on the internet, on the global satsang. And tonight we have New York and Ann Arbor and Detroit. And we've been talking to Ann Arbor and Detroit all day today. And Canada and Germany and in Ganeshpuri, Swami Govindananda's there. And also someone is watching in Arunachala, which is where Raman Maharshi's ashram is. Or should I say that person is marinating there. And in Japan, and several places in Japan, and several places in Adelaide, in Brisbane, Noosa, Sunshine Coast, in Byron Bay, Oya, Parham, Saji, and Raylene. Hello. And here in the ashram, Devima is watching. In Paramananda. And also in all around Melbourne. I want to welcome a new person, Steve, and a semi-new person, Frank. So welcome, you guys. All right, welcoming. Enough welcoming. I feel tired. I used to have the job of welcoming guests to Baba's ashram in Ganeshpuri. I worked in the front hall. You come off the road and you cross a very small courtyard and you're in the hall. Then that was the main hall. My day was the main hall of the ashram. And there's the statue of Bhagwan Nityananda, like our statue. And we used to have all the programs that we did. Guru Gita there, we did the Shiva Mahimna. Baba met people there and spoke there and so on. Later it was replaced by a bigger space called Guru Chowk. But I used to work in the hall and I would be on duty and I'd sweep the hall, and then when there's a chant I would give out the chanting books. And then if foreign guests came, I would be the one who showed them around the ashram. In those days, if you came to visit at all, you get a complete tour everywhere in the back, in the upper garden, everywhere, and then culminated with introducing them to Baba. So for me, that was the best job you could ever imagine, because you walk around the ashram, beautiful, but the real thing was I'd just be talking to the person, getting information, so that when I came to before Baba, I could tell Baba all about this person. So of course I got darshan of Baba, which was the payoff for me. So it was a really great thing, and there was so much welcome in that. So I was part of the welcoming function. So I'm still welcoming. So anyway, these programs every Saturday night. There's a theme. Of course, the theme is what Baba's teaching was, which is to know the self. And this is the teaching of all the great yogis and the great beings, is to know who we really are in the most profound way. And if we come to know who we really are, not in our ego way, not in our temporary way, in our personality way, but in terms of our essence, of our truest self, if we know that inner self, it's totally transformative, because we grow up with all kinds of false notions about who we are. And it's no trivial thing to discover who we are. It takes a lot of self-work and work on yourself and introspection, meditation, contemplation. And the greatest aid we have in that quest, that's called the spiritual quest, of the spiritual path. All the other paths are paths, external paths, paths in getting to know ourselves in the world or operating the world or getting and acquiring things and money and status and so on in the world. But the spiritual path is about knowing our true self, and that's only by a movement within. And the great aid, as I was saying, to that are the great beings, the realized beings, the enlightened beings, the great ones like the Buddha, like Jesus. And these are the greatest aid that we have. And this is, I always think of it as the hidden wealth of humanity. I didn't know that these people existed until a certain day in February of 1970. And the day that I discovered that great beings existed, even now, not just back in the days of the Buddha, but they existed now, that was the day I decided that I would find one and learn from that person. I thought, that's unbelievable. And that's exactly what happened. About 6 months later, I was off to India. But before I went to India, I started to study the teachings of one particular being. This was my first spiritual teacher, although I never met him, he long since departed. But he still had a big impact on me. And he was
this fellow, G.I. Gurdjieff, the mysterious and influential spiritual teacher Gurdjieff, and possibly the first great being to manifest in the Western world in modern times. He was born around 1870, and he died around 1949 to be exact. That was interesting because 1949-50 was a big watershed. A number of great beings died at that time. Not only Gurdjieff, but Raman Maharshi, or Sri Aurobindo. And so there are certain dates that the departures of these great souls, but they're always being replenished. There are always great souls to replace them. And then, so seekers can always find a teacher. In 1982, when Baba died, around the same time, within a year of that, Sri Nisargadatta and Ananda Mama also departed. So I don't know what the significance is, but there you go. Anyway, he became a very influential teacher in the West. He grew up in Eastern Turkey, and his parentage was Greek and Armenian. And even before I had that encounter with Ramdas, which turned me towards the East, I was starting to read some Gurdjieff, because a friend of mine in New York was a big student of his. And so he said, "You got to read this, you got to read this." So I read some of it, and I was impressed. and I was very aware as we were driving east, we drove through Turkey, and Eastern Turkey was really Gurdjieff's country, and I was very aware of him. Everybody looked like Gurdjieff there. He was stopping at a tea shop. It was just amazing. Anyway, he was he had studied with clearly with Sufi masters in the East, but you couldn't believe a word he said. He was quite a mysterious guy, and he hid his personal history, and he told you all kinds of stories, and you didn't know whether they were complete fabrications or the literal truth. So you always have to take. He was a big jokester. He was quite hilarious. You got another picture of him? This is a younger Gurdjieff. So he emerged at the beginning of World War I, traveled to France, and he went to America. He made quite a splash among kind of the artists, intellectuals of the time. And he gave mysterious programs full of very extraordinary dancing. I don't have a clip, but his dance movements are quite amazing. Around 1930, the New Yorker magazine noticed his presence, and they called him a philosopher. That's a good term for what he is. He's a spiritual teacher, a guru, but there's no category really like that. So a philosopher in the highest sense. And he said he held court several times a day in Child's Restaurant in New York City, in Manhattan, in which he drank endless coffees and spoke to people. The New Yorker said he spoke to aesthetes and ladies who think deeply. It's a different time. Isn't that wonderful? His basic teachings were simple. He said that in our present state, man is a machine. That you and I are mechanical, we're machines. And that means that we are just the product of our upbringing, our conditioning, and that we don't really have choice. We're wind-up dolls. And we just operate by reflex. We don't make choice. We can develop choice by doing what he called the work. The work meant spiritual practice, spiritual path. And as we work on ourselves and know about ourselves, then we develop real choice. So we separate ourselves from our conditioning, and then we have the ability to choose in the right direction. And he said the work begins with two things. One is self-observation, to see how we really are, to look at ourselves in an objective way. We are objectively subjective, or subjectively objective, or something. But to really see ourselves, you remember that old poem by Robert Burns, would somebody the gift would give us? The gift he gives, to see ourselves as others see us. Scottish poet Robert Burns said, I wish somebody would give us the gift to see ourselves as others see us. That's scary, isn't it? But that's really what it is, to see ourselves clearly, not through a filter of our self-conceit and our self-imagining. So self-observation, and the second part of that is self-remembering, which is to contact the self. It's similar to remembering the I am, the aham, or it's similar to saying the mantra, anything that puts us in touch with the higher self. And he says if you do that, you develop certain chemicals of higher consciousness, which is both metaphorical and I think quite possibly true. I wonder if one day science will be able to discover what these chemicals are. They'd have to dissect spiritual seekers and see what's in their brains. Some serotonin or something, I don't know. And he also taught the fourth way, which I'll explain in a minute. He was a great teacher, but his literary style left something to be desired. But fortunately, he had a disciple named Uspensky, whose picture's there, who was very serious, a very serious Russian mathematician and philosopher. In our terms, very solid. And he was trying to seek higher consciousness, and he went all over the East, as you'll hear, and then finally he met Gurdjieff, but back in Moscow. He didn't have any success going to the East. But Uspensky had a genius for exposition, literary exposition. And so he wrote a book called In Search of the Miraculous, which is an incredibly lucid depiction of Gurdjieff's teachings, much better than Gurdjieff himself could do, although it quoted a lot of what Gurdjieff said. And so tonight I'm going to look at something by Uspensky, but it's not from In Search of the Miraculous, it's from another book called The Fourth Way. And Gurdjieff said there are four paths, or three paths. Pardon me. The way of the fakir, which means the way of the physical yogi. Fakir does all kinds of physical practices, like fasting, austerities, things like that. Hatha yoga, all things to do with the body, and pranayama, all these things that are physical, and that's one path. Then he said there's a second path called the way of the monk. And that's the path of devotion. I guess he had in mind like Christian monks who are very devotional. And the way of the monk is a heart-centered yoga full of love, and you develop love and you purify that love and you can attain the ultimate through that love. That's the second one. And the third way, he said, was called what he called the way of the yogi. But in our terms, that means the way of the path of wisdom, centered in the third eye. We call it the way of yana yoga, or yani, the way of the yani. And so these are three ways, he said, these are classical ways. People, according to their nature, follow one or more of these ways, but principally one of these ways. Some people are devotional, some people are intellectual, and also the way of the the fakir is also karma yoga, people who serve, and they practice that. All of these are possible to attain the ultimate, but Gurdjieff taught the fourth way. And charmingly enough, he called that fourth way the way of the sly man. And what he meant was, such a person wouldn't wear a costume of any kind, wouldn't be visible. All the others are all in some kind of garb or other, like I am. But would just appear like a normal person. His yoga would be, his or her yoga would be completely inward. There wouldn't be any special monastery or ashram or place to do it. It would do it in the world. It would be moving, and it would make all of life the arena of yoga, the way of sly man. So slyly would turn everything into yoga. And I think all of us have to do this practice also. It's fine to come to satsang and to practice and to meditate. But the way of the sly man means that in your life, in your job, in your career, in your relationship, in your family, amongst your friends, moving through the world, you practice the way of the sly man. What does that mean in our terms? We would call it the way of the clear space of good feeling. It means we stay in contact with the self, no matter what arises in the world. A lot of things arise in the world to bring you down. It's as though an evil creator has put all these obstacles in our path. Every day, miserable, obnoxious people do horrible things to us. And every day we get what we don't get what we want, and we get what we don't want. And so from a spiritual point of view, we're tested many times every day. And so from a worldly point of view, it's all about getting what we want and not getting what we don't want. But from a spiritual point of view, it's about staying in that space of clarity and peace. Bhavana Rakho is what Bhagavan Nityananda called it, the clear space of good feeling. And so the way of the sly man is to maintain peace and equanimity in life, no matter what arises. No matter what anybody says or does or what happens, to stay in that place. And if you can't stay in that place and you lose it, work to get back to it. And when you're in it, work to stay there. And so this is the way of the sly man. Uspensky became a teacher in his own right. And he gave a bunch of talks, and they were recorded or written down, and he put them together, and he called his book The Fourth Way. This is the beginning of The Fourth Way, a very interesting book, and see how far we get with it. Uspensky writes, "Before I begin to explain to you in a general way what this system is about and to talk about our methods, I want to particularly impress on your minds that the most important ideas and principles of the system do not belong to me. This is chiefly what makes them valuable, because if they belonged to me, they would be like all other theories invented by ordinary minds. They would only give a subjective view of things." It's very interesting because he's not saying that I got him from Gurdjieff. He doesn't mention that here. But he acknowledges that he got him from a teacher. And for example, the teachings here, you know, are not invented by me or by anybody, but they come from an ancient tradition. And Baba used to always say, when he heard about new teachings, he'd say, new, what is new? You say, you know, these things are ancient. These are the hidden wisdom of humanity, and they've been available forever. It's just that most people don't know about it. They're in the Sufi tradition, they talk about the open secret. It's a marvelous concept. It means that's hidden in plain view. It's like something that's right there in front of you, but you don't see it. And so the spiritual teachings are right there in front of us, and we don't see it. We go do everything else. But one day, things happen, conditions are right, we are right, things happen, suddenly become aware that there's a whole other dimension of life and that we need to go down that path. That's the open secret. He goes on. When I began to write a new model of the universe in 1907, he was a very accomplished man, quite well known in Moscow and so on, and he'd written these philosophical mathematical works. One of them was this, A New Model of the Universe. Very modest title, isn't it? A New Model of the Universe. I formulated to myself, as many other people have done before and since, that behind the surface of the life which we know lies something much bigger and more important. Here's really the history of Uspensky's awakening, that he came to say that all the explanations that he's heard till now don't go deep enough. There's something deeper. There's something deeper. And I said to myself then that until we know more about what lies behind, all our knowledge of life and of ourselves is really negligible. Did you come to that same point in your life? Because I did. I know I did in the late 60s. I thought, everything that I'm getting, and I went to university and graduate school, and I met many professors, famous professors, and the knowledge they gave was fine. It was very good in its field, but none of it satisfied a deep yearning to know the profound and underlying truth of things. I thought, what is the use of this until I understand what life is about, what I'm about? So this is the point he reached. And this is how he looked at it. He says, I remember one conversation at that time when I said, if it were possible to accept as proven that consciousness, or as I should now call it, intelligence, can manifest itself apart from the physical body, many other things could be proved. Only it cannot be taken as proved. I realized that manifestations of supernormal psychology, such as thought transference, clairvoyance, the possibility of knowing the future, of looking back into the past and so on, have not been proved. So I get from that he must have been, because in that 19th century it was a big fad in seances and all kinds of things, ESP. And so he probably dabbled in all that, mind reading and clairvoyance, all this stuff. The relationship of consciousness to the body. So he says, so I tried to find a method of studying these things and worked on that line for several years. I found some interesting things in that way, but the results were very elusive, and though several experiments were successful, it was almost impossible to repeat them. I came to two conclusions in the course of these experiments. First, that we do not know enough about ordinary psychology, and we cannot study supernormal psychology because we do not know normal psychology. That's a very good conclusion. We can't worry about thought transference and all these cities, these powers of mind. We don't really know what the heck constitutes our normal psychology, a normal condition. Second, I came to the conclusion that certain real knowledge exists, that there may be schools which know exactly what we want to know, but for some reason they are hidden, and this knowledge is hidden. And that's the point I came to when I met Ram Dass in Chicago in 1970, that this knowledge does exist. I didn't know it existed, or that people who have this knowledge exist. And that's a great moment where you say, oh, it exists, it has always existed, and there are people who understand it. So he called it that there are mystery schools. I guess I would call it schools of second education, schools that don't teach just mathematics and geography and English composition and whatever, everything that's taught in schools, but teach the inner knowledge. So we went off in search of mystery schools. So I began to look for these schools. I traveled in Europe, Egypt, India, Ceylon, Turkey, and the Near East. But it was really later, when I'd already finished these travels, that I met in Russia during the war a group of people who were studying a certain system, which came originally from Eastern schools. He's being a little bit less than candid, because he met a person, Gurdjieff, who embodied this knowledge and had carried it, and then he met the people around him who were studying with him. This system began with the study of psychology exactly as I realized it must begin, the study of our own psychology. The chief idea of the system was that we do not use even a small part of our powers and our forces. We have in us, so to speak, a very big potential, only we do not know how to make use of it. You think that's true? What do you think? We're always looking to enhance it, to get the right vitamin, or the right supplement, or the right drug, or the right something that will enhance us. And we believe, if we have enough protein, we'll be whole. We'll be empowered. The yogis say there's something else, something else. He says, in this group, this is quite beautiful, they employed certain oriental metaphors. And they told me that we have in us a large house full of beautiful furniture, with a library and many other rooms. But we live in the basement and the kitchen and cannot get out of them. If people tell us about what this house has upstairs, we do not believe them, or we laugh at them, or we call it superstition or fairy tales or fables. Isn't that true? If you talk about higher consciousness in certain circles, they'll just say that's nonsense, that's a lot of thing. But there are potentialities and possibilities. He says, the study of man is closely connected with the idea of the evolution of man, humanity. But the evolution of man must be understood in a slightly different way from the ordinary. Ordinarily, the word evolution applied either to a human being or to anything else presupposed a kind of mechanical evolution. So don't forget, if he's writing this in the 20s, and Darwin had made a big impact in the 19th century, and everyone spoke about evolution. And after the physical evolution, then the social Darwinists came forward, philosophers like Herbert Spencer and so on, and they talked about the evolution of culture and of, psychology. So he's saying that this is different from just brute physical evolution. He says, I meant that certain things by certain known or unknown laws transform into other things, and these other things transform into still others, and so on. What's he talking about? The transformation of consciousness. In practical terms, it means the transformation of a miserable, frightened, angry and depressed person into a joyous and wise and illumined person. That's the best transformation conceivable, isn't it? And that transformation is possible through practice, through yoga. But from the point of view of this system, there's no such evolution at all. We do not speak in general, but specifically of human beings. The evolution of man, if it occurs, can only be the result of knowledge and effort. As long as man knows only what he can know in the ordinary way, there is no evolution for him, and there never was any evolution for him. Saying that without practice, without being intentional and doing something, we can't evolve. We can just exist, but we can't evolve. Serious study begins in this system with the study of psychology, that is to say, with the study of oneself, because psychology cannot be studied as astronomy can outside oneself. A person has to study himself. When I was told that, I saw at once that we do not have any methods of studying ourselves and already have many wrong ideas about ourselves. So I realized we must get rid of wrong ideas about ourselves and at the same time find methods for studying ourselves. So that's it. It's a two-way path. It's very simple in its basics. One way is to get rid of the false, the wrong ideas we have, the wrong conditioning, and they're very easy to see in other people. You know how wrong-headed all your friends are? They just have so many stupid ideas about themselves and about the world. They're just so stupid. And then the other is to move in the right direction, for which we need two things. We need good guidance and also some work on ourselves, some practice. He says, I'm not going to continue this. Are you still awake and alive?
Yeah,
it's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll go on for a bit. He says, perhaps you realize how difficult it is to define what is meant by psychology. There are so many meanings attached to the same words in different systems that it's difficult to have a general definition. So we begin by defining psychology as study of oneself. That's nice. You have to learn certain methods and principles, and according to these principles and using these methods, you will try to see yourself from a new point of view. If we begin to study ourselves, we first of all come up against one word which we use more than any other, and that is the word... What? What?
I.
He's right. The doctor is correct. That is the word I. We say, I am doing, I am sitting, I feel, I like, I dislike, and so on. This is our chief illusion. For the principal mistake we make about ourselves is that we consider ourselves one. We always speak about ourselves as I, and we suppose we refer to the same thing all the time, when in reality, we are divided into hundreds and hundreds of different I's. Now, this is it's a very interesting idea. It seems like at odds with the normal teaching about the true self, but actually, when we think in terms of ego, ego personality, there are thousands of eyes. There's you when you're happy. There's you when you're sad. There's you when you're depressed. There's you when you're jealous. There's you when you're what? What? We said that already. When you're sad, when you're lacking. And then you, when you're peaceful, they're all different yous, and you have different thoughts, you have different feelings, and you behave differently, and you speak differently. And your friends know that when you're one of some of your yous, you don't want to be around. While some of your yous, people like to be around. and you know that of other people. Oh, how is that one today? Don't want to go near that person today. Wait till that person calms down. And so these are all different eyes within us. This is what he means by it. Here's how he explains it. He says, at one moment when I say I, one part of me is speaking. At another moment when I say I, it's quite another part speaking. We do not know that we have not one I, but many different eyes connected with our feelings and desires, and have no controlling eye. These eyes change all the time. One suppresses another, one replaces another. When you feel jealous, all your good eyes disappear, and all you have is just jealousy. And then you become a beast in the jungle. And all this struggle makes up our inner life. Of course, Baba would say there is a permanent I, and that's the self. Or you could call it the clear space of good feeling. Gurdjieff called it the center of gravity. In Hindu thought, they call it stitta prajna, steady wisdom. There's a something solid behind all the shifting eyes of personality. There's the solid eye of the true self. But you have to go behind the veil to get to that eye. He goes on, eyes which we see in ourselves are divided into several groups. Some of these groups are legitimate, and they belong to right divisions of a person. And some of them are quite artificial and are created by insufficient knowledge and by certain imaginary ideas that a person has about himself. I would say tearing thoughts belong to that. When we're obsessed by tearing thoughts, thoughts of self-hatred, where we attack ourselves, that then we're under the influence of eyes that are not true and they're wrong, but they're so powerful. They bring us down, they depress us terribly, and we get deflated and miserable from it. He says, well, I'm going to stop because it goes on. And we'll go on because he continues on, this is all about self-observation, but then he goes on to the other part, which is self-remembering. And self-remembering is a wonderful... and we need... He also says we need alarm clocks to wake us up. Hey, George.
I'm not here.
Is it for me? All right. I think I'll leave it there, though. How is that? Is that interesting?
Really?
Yes.
Okay. It's a very lucid and kind of, you'd say, Western kind of exposition of spirituality. So the first thing is self-observation, to see ourselves, and the second is self-remembering. But I'd like to practice a little self-remembering right now. And one way that... Gurdjieff explained self-remembering is always, it was like he said, make awareness a two-way arrow. When you look at something, your arrow of attention goes that way, also go this way, so that you remember the person at this side of it. So when you point your finger like this, and see, who's that pointing at? Who is that finger pointing at? So always keep that person in the equation. So you look both ways. That's called self-remembering. It's to remember the subject, the self. And he says that if you practice self-remembering, and that was the practice I was doing before I got to India. I started practicing intense self-remembering. And it was a very interesting experiment. And he said that builds spiritual muscles. And then when I got to India, I found that a lot of the great yogis taught a similar practice like Raman Maharshi and like Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj. So let's practice some basic self-remembering. We'll do 10-minute meditation. And we'll take this word, I. Take this word, I. The word, I, only refers this way. It only refers towards the interior. You can't look for I outside yourself or in other people. It has to be a movement towards that which is interior, intimate, and inner. So use the word I as the device that gets you in the right direction. And say to yourself, I. And look inside where that word points. We say I all the time. And as he said, there are many, many different I's. But what is the fundamental I behind all the other I's? The I that's always there. When you're jealous, your happy I disappears. But then when you're happy, your jealous I disappears. But the real I is behind all of those other I's. What is that I? Search within yourself for that I. The secret to this is to move from thought to feeling, to move from thinking I to feeling I. What does it feel like to be you? What does it feel like? Feel your way into that I. And we'll meditate for 10 minutes, and for the first couple of minutes at least, try to hang on to the feeling of I-ness. And after that, you can meditate as you want, but see if you can hold on to that. This is very high-level self-remembering. Begin with the word I and take it into what feeling that it points to and hold on to it as best you can. Don't let other thoughts deflect you from it. If they do, say I again and move towards that feeling state. So let's meditate now for 10 minutes. And once again, with great respect and love, I welcome you all with all my heart. Satguru Nat, Maharaj Ki Jai. Let's meditate.